This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
الحمد لله الحمد لله خالق الوجود من العدم وجاعل النور من الظلم ومخرج الصبر من الألم فملقي التوبة على الندم فنشكره على المصائب كما نشكره على النعم ونصلي على رسوله الأكرم بالشرف الأشم والنور الأتم والكتاب المحكم وكمال النبيين والخاتم سيدي ولدي آدم الذي بشر به عيسى بن مريم ودعا لبعثته إبراهيم عليه السلام حين كان يرفع قواعد بيت الله المحرم فصلى الله عليه وسلم وعلى أتباعه خير الأمم الذين بارك الله بهم كافة الناس العرب منهم والعجم الحمد لله الذي لم يتخذ ولدا ولم يكن له شريك في الملك ولم يكن له ولي من الذل وكبره تكبيرا والحمد لله الذي أنزل على عبده الكتاب ولم يجعل له عوجا والحمد لله الذي نحمده ونستعينه ونستغفره ونؤمن به ونتوكل عليه ونعوذ بالله من شرور أنفسنا ومن سيئات أعمالنا من يهده الله فلا مضل له ومن يضلل فلا هادي له ونشهد أن لا إله إلا الله وحده لا شريك له ونشهد أن محمدًا عبد الله ورسوله أرسله الله تعالى بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله وكفى بالله شهيدا فصلى الله عليه وسلم تسليما كثيرا كثيرا أما بعد فإن أصدق الحديث كتاب الله وخير الهدي هدي محمد صلى الله عليه وسلم وإن شر الأمور محدثاتها وإن كل محدثة بدعة وكل بدعة ضلالة وكل ضلالة في النار قال الله عز وجل في كتابه الكريم بعد أن أقول أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم الرجال قوامون على النساء بما فضل الله بعضهم على بعض وبما أنفقوا من أموالهم فالصالحات قانتات حافظات للغيب بما حفظ الله واللاتي تخافون نشوزهن فعظوهن واهجروهن في المضاجع واضربوهن فإن أطعنكم فلا تبغوا عليهن سبيلا إن الله كان عليا كبيرا رب اشرح لي صدري ويسر لي أمري واحلل عقدة من لساني يفقه قولي واللهم ثبتنا عند الموت بلا إله إلا الله واللهم اجعلنا من الذين آمنوا وعملوا الصالحات وتواصوا بالحق وتواصوا بالصبر آمين يا رب العالمين There are a lot of items on my plate today and I'm hoping in a concise amount of time I'm able to communicate everything that I'd like to share with you in this khutbah clearly and effectively and in a way that will be beneficial to myself and to all of you. So I ask Allah for clarity in speech as I recited the dua of Musa alayhi salam in the very beginning. I invoke on that dua again and I ask you to make dua the same way that Allah gives me clarity in my speech. The first thing I want to talk about is actually something that was raised as a concern and a legitimate one. Why talk about the same topic over and over again over the course of so many khutbahs? Just get to the point already, right? And I actually want to address that a little bit because it's important. There are things in Allah's book that you can have differences of opinion on. Like, for example, is Khadir a man or an angel? You can have differences of opinion on it. Or some people can believe that they know what the number of people was that was in the cave in Surah Al-Kahf. That's fine if you believe that was a certain number and the Quran hints at it. Or you don't believe that the Quran is clear about a number. It's okay. Those differences of opinion are not life and death issues. So you can have one view or the other and life goes on. There are other teachings in the Quran where there are, in fact, differences of opinion, and there is a lot of common misunderstanding, or some things are presented as though there's only one way of looking at them, and they actually have real life impact. They can affect a family, they can affect a marriage, they can affect the way children are raised, and as a result, they can affect entire generations. And this ayah is one of those places. If we don't discuss this ayah or really try to deeply understand patiently what this ayah is getting at, even if you don't agree with the conclusions that I'm going to reach, which I'll address second, the fact that this ayah does impact family life very directly and is a very fundamental principle, because the Quran addresses extreme situations in Surah An-Nisa. It actually addresses not the norm, but the extremities. And that's the nature of constitutional laws. The constitutions of any nation or any great legal document, one of its qualities is that it does not actually address the normal in life. It addresses the extreme, outliers. So for example, laws will discuss things like murder or robbery, etc., criminal law. Why? Not everybody's a murderer. Not everybody's a robber. But in case that happens, that extreme takes place, we need to be able to deal with it, right? So the same way, Surah An-Nisa is a good example of laws that are in such circumstances, what are you supposed to do? In places in which there's room for lots of conflict. And in that context, this ayah has been given to us. So the other thing that I will share with you, and I say this with all sincerity, we have to be humble to our own ignorance. So what I'm going to share with you is actually based on a research paper written by a dear colleague of mine, Saqib Hussain, who is, mashallah, a very well-versed scholar of the deen and also of comparative religion, and is pretty much on his way of completing his PhD at Oxford University after having studied Islam exhaustively, and is familiar with both the Arabic language exhaustively and also the Hebrew Bible, and is versed in Hebrew as well. And he wrote a paper, an exhaustive paper, on this ayah, on Surah An-Nisa, ayah number 34. He wrote a 46-page paper on it in English. And actually, on social media today, I have put a link for that paper in the description. What he's talked about is way more complicated than what I present in the khutbah. My job in the khutbah is try to simplify things as much as possible and take them step by step. But I think for many of us, this issue is important enough that you should educate yourself higher. And so one quick comment before I get to the conclusions that are made in that paper that I find more convincing than other conclusions is that we as Muslims have to know that our religion, Islam, is different, not just because we worship one God and some religions worship multiple gods, or we have our prayers on Friday and they have theirs on Saturday or Sunday. It's not just different because of our rituals are different or our beliefs are different. It's not just different for those reasons. It's different for some other fundamental reasons too. And one of those reasons is Allah made it so that we become informed believers. أدعو إلى الله على بصيرة أنا ومن اتبعني. I call to Allah with clear insight. I and whoever follows me. This is what the Prophet was commanded to say, sallallahu alaihi wasallam. You know what that means? That we're informed followers of our religion. That we're actually supposed to study and learn the issues that are important in our religion and have access to the direct sources. There are major religions in the world where for a long time, there were two extremes. On one extreme, you cannot access the book. Only the ordained minister or priest or pope can tell you what the Bible says. You cannot tell. You don't have authority to read what it says or to ask questions about it because you'll be blaspheming. And on the other extreme is the extreme reaction. I'm going to read the Bible my way. You can read it your way. This is my conclusion. That's your conclusion. Let's all just do our own thing. So this one thing can mean a million things. And for a million people, it means a million things. So there's no truth anymore because the truth has become entirely arbitrary. It's like, you know, when you take a dot and you can draw a million infinite number of lines through it, a dot. That's what they do with religion sometimes. So you can have your truth, I can have my truth. So on the one hand, there are a group of people that say, no, we have authority over the truth. And on the other, no one has authority over the truth. We're all the authority over the truth. So you get these two extremes. What did our religion do? It demanded on us to contemplate our deen. It demanded on us to seek and understand. It demanded on us that we have to think. And then it demanded on us to not just come to our own conclusions, but to ask questions, to inquire, and to lead ourselves to what is the strongest evidence. This is actually revolutionary. This is the approach you take in science. This is the approach you take in investigating history. This is the approach you take in any field of knowledge when you want that knowledge to be more and more and more refined. You don't just take somebody else's conclusions and say, they already concluded, I don't have to think about this again. No, you reinvestigate, you ask questions, you come to your own conclusions, and there's no such thing as a blind acceptance of any conclusion. Everything is transparent, everything is open, and that is profoundly revolutionary. And that is why we have such respect for our scholarship, because they didn't just say, do this, don't do this. They said, do this, and here are my reasons for why we think you should do this. Or this is our conclusion, and this is our process. They don't just tell you the conclusion, they try to outline the process that led them to that conclusion. And then other scholars can come along and say, I disagree with you. I'm looking at the same evidence, but I'm coming to a different conclusion, and here are my reasons. And you know what happens then? Healthy debate happens. healthy conversation happens. One doesn't call the other kafir, but they understand each other's different thought processes. You understand? And this itself is a revolutionary thing. This is not something you associate with religion. In religion, you assume people just follow without asking any questions. This is what makes us different. This is what makes the citizenship of Islam, all of us equal. Not just equal that we stand in the same line in prayer, but all of us equal that we all have the right to inquire. We all have the right to seek a better understanding, right? And we don't necessarily arbitrarily say, well, my conclusion is this. No, my conclusion is subject to criticism. My conclusion can be questioned by somebody, not on the basis of my appearance or my accent or my background, but on the basis of the evidences that I'm providing. Somebody can say, you presented this evidence, but what about this counter-argument? What about that counter-argument, right? So this is the process by which we refine our understanding. And this is a really mature approach to our religion. And so the conclusions that I'm going to share with you that I find convincing, I've studied tafsir of this ayah since I started studying the Quran. Particularly Surah An-Nisa, I wanted to understand what's going on here and some other places. And it seemed to me that a lot of times the conclusions that are being reached in our traditional sources are essentially saying somebody already did the work, let's just conclude what they concluded, and we kind of replicate what's already been said. In constitutional terms, they call this legal precedent. Legal precedent meaning somebody else already reached a conclusion. Because they reached that conclusion, we can lean on their conclusion. We don't have to revisit the issue again. So with few exceptions, in some places in the Quran, people really leaned on, you know, pre-existing conclusions that have been reached by scholarship and didn't revisit them again. And nowadays, there's also a fear. I should caveat all of what I'm going to say with this because I think this is important. People assume your intentions when you're trying to do research. They assume you're trying to come up with a new interpretation of Islam that's trying to be liberal or progressive or in with the times, etc., etc. I just want to be open upfront with you and say, I'm not interested in being politically correct. In fact, you'll see that the conclusions that I'm trying to share with you aren't politically correct. They're actually not. They would be in the modern liberal sensibility, they would be actually pretty unpopular conclusions. But they are what the Quran says. So we have to be open and upfront with what Allah's word says. I don't have, and as a Muslim, I believe that the case should be, we shouldn't feel intimidated by being in line with the current circumstances. And the same way, we shouldn't be intimidated by being loyal to our history at the expense of the text. The text, the kalimatullah hiya al-a'la. Wa kalimatullah hiya al-a'la. This is the word of Allah is in the highest place. And so this is why our great scholars, they learned from their teachers, and at the end of 20 years of learning from them, they ended up concluding something different. That's actually our history too. And that's a show of their loyalty to the word of Allah, to seeking the truth. And I pray all of us become like that and we raise a generation of kids that are like that and lead us in a way that we couldn't do ourselves. So I want to start talking about this ayah, and I want you to understand the controversy or the conclusions that I'm going to disagree with are rooted in one word in this ayah. And the word is not hitting. That's actually not where the controversy or the conflict of opinion lies. The real issue is, what is nushuz? That's actually the real issue. Nushuz, which I talked about last week, was uprising, and I tried to connect it to infidelity. I connected to a wife cheating on her husband. That's what I talked about last time. And I tried to give the evidences for why nushuz in this ayah means infidelity. Now, the scholars that disagree with this position that I'm going to share, they believe that nushuz means any disobedience. It actually means disobedience. So if you asked your wife to cook and she didn't want to cook, that's a kind of nushuz. If you asked her to come to bed and she didn't want to come to bed, that's a kind of nushuz. That is their view. I'm arguing based on the textual evidence and based on the contextual evidence that nushuz actually in the ayah means disobedience. It does not mean disobedience. It actually means infidelity, rebellion in the institution of marriage itself, what makes the marriage sacred itself. Which is why it makes sense that the same word nushuz was used for men. And in ayah number 128, وَإِنْ إِمْرَأَةٌ خَافَتْ مِنْ بَعْلِهَا نُشُوزًا, nushuz is mentioned for men also. Because for men, it's not an issue of disobeying the wife, just like it's not in the first case. It's actually a violating the institution, the sacred institution of marriage. And that's why that's being mentioned there too. The other issue is, we're not afraid, or we're, you know, when you mention fear is of something that hasn't happened yet. That's what fear is. Disobedience has already happened. You're not afraid that your wife is not going to put enough salt in the chicken, You're afraid of something that you haven't verified yet. And so the ayah is talking about something anticipated, something assumed that hasn't taken place yet. And that's, for more on that, inshallah, read the paper and also kind of listen to the khutbah from last week on what nushuz means. Here I would argue that it means infidelity. Now, if it does in fact mean infidelity, then we have another issue. And that is that there are two surahs I'd like you to remember. There are two surahs. Suratun Nisa, which is what we're looking at, Nisa, ayah number 34. And there's Suratun Nur, which is surah number 24. So 4 and 24 to make it easy, right? These two surahs talk about similar subjects. They're actually in Revelation. They're close to each other in the time of Revelation, in Medina, in the middle period. And also, this one talks about what should be the punishment of zina. Suratun Nisa, early punishments of zina. And Suratun Nur, also punishments of zina. There are other parallels between these two surahs. The ethics between men and women, the code of marriage, all of that's been discussed. The two fundamental places you go to in the Quran are either Suratul Nisa or you go to Suratul Nur. You know, those are the two that are really deeply connected to each other, though the subject is talked about elsewhere too. Now, having said that, if this ayah means nushuz, what did Allah say about, we're talking about women today, not men, but I will say, in this also the Quran is revolutionary. It's absolutely revolutionary. In the Arabic language, you have nouns that could be masculine or feminine. So you have muslimun, masculine, muslimatun, feminine. You add a ta marbuta at the end, and the word becomes feminine. Katib is a writer, katibatun is feminine. But there are some words that are only used for women. There are some words that are only used for women. So there's no need to add the ta marbuta because you're never going to use it for a man. Like ha'ib is a woman who's menstruating. She's had a period. You don't need to say ha'iba because there's no masculine feminine. It's just one. It's only applicable for women. So they say ha'ib. Same way for a pregnant woman, they don't say hamila, they say hamil. Hamil means pregnant woman. Even though there's no tamarbuta. Why? Because some words, by common sense, can't be used for men. And similarly, in Arabic literature before Islam, nashes was only used for women. Women that are cheating on their man were called nashes in poetry and other examples. And the Quran is revolutionary because for the first time, the Quran said this crime can be committed by a man just like it can be committed by a woman. By the Arabic literary heritage, this word was only associated with women. But in ayah number 34, Allah connected it to women. And in ayah number 128, Allah also connected it to men. And so Allah Azza wa Jal has actually revealed something profound here. This is a crime against Allah, not a crime against a man or a woman. And so a man can be guilty of it and a woman can be guilty of it. Now how that's going to be dealt with is going to be different, and I'll address that in a separate khutbah. Having said all of that, what did Allah say if a man fears that his wife is not being loyal? Actually, it's not talking to the husband. This is the next thing we're going to talk about. وَالَّاتِ تَخَافُونَ نُشُوزَهُنَّ. Those who you are afraid are being rebellious, and I've already defined what rebellious means, who is Allah talking to? Allah is actually using the plural form here as if to say husbands are included, but it could be that the husband didn't notice. The husband didn't notice, but the father-in-law noticed. It could be the brother noticed, her brother noticed that she's doing something that her husband doesn't know. It could be her other family members noticed. Her cousins noticed, her uncle noticed, her aunt noticed. Everybody's talked about, and that's why when we get to فَعِظُوهُنَّ, counsel them, it's not limited to the man counseling the wife. It could be, there's an openness, it's tawassu' in kalam. What it could be is, it could be anybody who's noticing this kind of thing, maybe I should bring it up. And now let's understand what maw'idha means. Maw'idha doesn't mean that you go to your cousin and say, hey, by the way, I noticed you're cheating on your husband. That's not what it's saying. It's saying maybe you should just open up, talk to them, because wa'idh means to say something that reaches the heart. Hey, are you feeling okay? How are things between you and Abdul Karim? Are things going well? I don't know. I don't know if I love him anymore. And the conversation opens up, right? And there's an opportunity to give. Maybe you could do this. Maybe you could do that. You're trying to find a soft way to fix something that you notice is steering in the wrong direction, right? And that could be done by the husband, but it could be done by others who notice too. It could be close family and friends that are noticing something and they're trying to help the situation. This is fa'idhuhunna. So there's an openness to it. But the second component is actually clear that it can only be the husband. وَاجْرُوهُنَّ فِي الْمَضَاجِعِ. If he notices that counsel was being given, but he's noticing that she's just becoming way too open talking to other men, she's way too friendly with the co-workers, co-workers calling at 11 o'clock at night, and they're talking for 30 minutes, laughing and this and that, and you know, and he's like, what was that about? No, it was just work. Didn't sound like just work. What's going on? You know, and he's like, he's bothered by that behavior, and it's now becoming extreme. Oh no, I'm going out. Who are you going out with? Oh, just some friends. Who are these friends? Wait, I didn't say you shouldn't be going. Well, you can't stop me. And then she goes out, and he's wondering what's going on. Or she just says, I'm really stressed out. I'm going out for a drive. Where are you going to go? Don't worry about it. Don't call me either. And she shows back up 3 hours later, 4 hours later. If he's going through that kind of mental hell, and he's trying to tell her, stop doing this, it's psychologically torturous to me. Talk to me about what's going on. This kind of thing isn't acceptable. You know, why are you so secretive? Why have you become so secretive? And why are you blocking me out from things you're doing? And all of that is escalating. Then the Quran's advice is, maybe you shouldn't be sleeping in the same bed. You should just sleep on the couch instead. Now, why is that there? There's a few effects of that. On the one hand, a wife that is in love with her husband, respects her husband, and respects the institution of marriage. When the husband says, I think I'm going to go sleep on the couch, it's a really hurtful thing to say. It's not an easy thing to hear. That means, does he hate me? Am I that disgusting? He's that mad at me? What have I even done? Like if he does that for no reason, right? She says, hey, so I wanted to ask you the other day, what did you mean by this? You know what? You asked me a question about what I meant. I think I'm going to go to the couch. Well, that's kind of crazy on your part. But if after counsel and after talking about how I don't think you're being very honest with me about the way you're communicating or the things you're up to, this thing has escalated to a point. He's so hurt by it that Allah is teaching him something also. You continuing to keep things as they are is enabling that behavior. You're actually making it okay for her to do whatever she's doing that's hurting you, and at the same time acting like everything is normal. So you need to take a stand and you need to step away. You need to sleep on the couch. You need to sleep in the kids' room or whatever. Figure something out. وَهْجُرُوهُنَّ فِي الْمَضَاجِعِ. Leave them in the beds. Now a wife will be that's emotionally attached to her husband will be bothered by that and say, let's talk about this. We need to figure this out. And if we can't figure this out, maybe you're not good at communicating with each other. Maybe every time you start talking about something, it turns into a fight. It turns into a nuclear explosion. It could happen. Maybe every time you say something right, it's interpreted the wrong way. You have a serious communication and understanding problem. If that's the case, there are people in the family that maybe you can solicit the help of, or maybe a counselor that you can go see. Somebody who's qualified, who's neutral, who's not going to guilt or bash one or the other, just hear both sides out and they just want things to work out better. Someone who can keep confidentiality, who's not going to hear you out and then later on broadcast that, you know what, these people are having so many problems, they even came to me to ask for help. You know, it's sad nowadays. No, what's sad is you're talking about it. You're disgusting because people trusted you with their personal life and you're making it a conversation piece. That's horrifying. So don't do that to people. But if family, friends, you know, because sometimes, let's be real, in our families, a lot of times, if you put a filter, you know how you can put a filter on your emails? You can put a filter on your searches? If you put a filter on your conversations, every time we're talking about somebody else or somebody else's family, we're going to stop talking after the first sentence. You'll find a lot of silence at home. Because most of the time, the conversations we're having is about who's having drama with who. And what's going on with somebody else's personal life. It's a horrible violation of our deen that we do that. You know, the Rasulullah tells us, لا تتبعوا عورات المسلمين. Don't become obsessed with the personal matters of other Muslims. But that's just become the most common thing for us to do. No, I'm just saying, I'm not saying anything. No, you saying I'm not saying anything is just you lying on top of saying it. This doesn't change anything. So the advice here being given, the extreme measure that's been taken is the beds have been separated. Now let me tell you, the Quran again describes the worst case scenario. Something else happens as a result, not just psychologically, but also socially. If in fact the worst thing possible is happening, he doesn't have proof. He doesn't have proof. But if such a thing is happening, and there is in fact a pregnancy, then the evidence will be clear. So maybe she'll stop dead in her tracks because now there's a paternity issue. And that sounds horrible to say, but that's a reality in the world that we're all too familiar with. This is something the Quran protected the men from and families from. So he said, وَحْجُرُوهُنَّ فِي الْمَضَاجِعِ. Now we get to the next part. The part for which I started this entire series. And that is if that hasn't changed anything. In fact, the idea is that that step being taken, which is not with conclusive evidence. By the way, Allah didn't say, وَاللَّاتِ تَعْلَمُونَ نُشُوزَهُنَّ. وَاللَّاتِ تَعْلَمُونَ نُشُوزَهُنَّ. If you know they're cheating on you. He didn't say that. He said, وَاللَّاتِ تَخَافُونَ نُشُوزَ. If you're afraid that they're doing that, which means you don't have conclusive evidence. You don't have conclusive, you have suspicion. Obviously, you know your wife better than anybody else. So if you have suspicions, they're warranted. Something's going on. Maybe you're just paranoid. It's possible. Maybe after all the assumptions you made, you were dead wrong. That's also possible. It's completely possible. But if these things are escalating, I need you to understand, it's not the same assumption. The first step was talk it out. Figure out what's going on. Is there something happening? Because you can just be straight with me and just tell me I'm ugly, or I don't like you anymore, or whatever. I wish I wasn't married to you. This was a huge... Just tell me straight up. Just tell me. It's okay. I'll hear it. But no, you're not being open with me, and yet you're still continuing that behavior. What that means then for a man is he now is gathering more evidence from before, from the counsel stage. He's even developed more reasons to be suspicious. It's not the original suspicion anymore because more red flags have been raised. And as more red flags have been raised, the reaction has become more severe, which is the separation of beds. But then even more red flags. So we're not 100% she knows she's doing something really evil. But the red flags are all, there's a lot of red flags and they're unignorable. To the point where the husband, without evidence, is convinced that she's actually doing the worst thing. It's reached that point. When it reaches that point, again, I keep re-emphasizing, without what? Without evidence. Clues are there, hints are there, explicit. He hasn't seen anything. He can't, because he's reached this point. Now let's go to other places in the Quran. Because we're going to pause at this point for a second. Allah says, يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا اجْتَنِبُوا كَثِيرًا مِنَ الظَّنِّ إِنَّ بَعْضَ الظَّنِّ إِثْمٌ. Believers, stay away from most kinds of assumptions. So even if he has red flags, assumptions, he doesn't have absolute evidence. So in the end, as close to reality as that may be, it's still a dhann. Now, because this is about zina, let's be open. This is about zina. Let's go to all places in the Quran that talk about the assumption of zina. So, I told you the two surahs that are connected to each other are Nisa and Nur. In Nisa, in this surah, earlier on in the 15th ayah, Allah told us, وَالَّذَانِ يَأْتِيَانِهَا مِنْكُمْ. You know, actually before that, وَالَّاتِ يَأْتِينَ الْفَاحِشَةَ مِنْ نِسَائِكُمْ فَاسْتَشْهِدُوا عَلَيْهِنَّ أَرْبَعَةً مِنْكُمْ. Those who have committed a shameless act among your women, you better seek four witnesses against them. Four people should testify they've done this act. And when we dig into what that means, four people have had to see without any shadow of the doubt that the ultimate evil act of zina had in fact taken place. Four people. That sounds next to impossible. But if that happened, then you know what it's talking about? It's talking about what in modern law we call the public display of indecency. If two people are doing zina in public enough that at least four people can know what's going on, that means they're not just committing a personal sin, they're committing a crime against society according to Islamic standards. And different countries have different laws for how they deal with public display of indecency. If somebody walks outside nude, they can get arrested. They can have some punishment. Islam devised a punishment for people that are doing the sexual act in public, and that was early on, if four witnesses were present, adhuhuma, punish them, give them pain. Now give them pain or hurt them is open-ended. What kind of pain do you want to give them? It's not specified yet, yes? Now, come back to the assumption. The assumption is that the husband suspects his wife. Allah Azza wa Jal took this four witness concept, and then revealed another surah, Surah An-Nur. And in Surah An-Nur, he took the same four witness concept and furthered the argument, explained it even further. And he said, لَوْلَا جَاءُوا عَلَيْهِ بِأَرْبَعَةِ شُهَدَاءِ فَإِنْ لَمْ يَأْتُوا بِالشُهَدَاءِ فَأُولَٰئِكَ عِنْدَ اللَّهِ هُمُ الْكَاذِبُونَ. How come the people who accuse somebody of doing zina, Allah said, how come they didn't produce four witnesses? And if they haven't produced four witnesses, then as far as Allah is concerned, they're liars. What is Allah saying? Four witnesses. Why is he saying four witnesses? Because it's already been told in Surah An-Nisa. And he's bringing up the same content. How can you accuse someone of this and you don't have four witnesses? But then how can a husband come up with four witnesses? It's impossible. All he has is either eyewitness account or he's nearly absolutely convinced. I saw them walk in together. I saw this or that. I don't have 100%, but I'm pretty much, I'm convinced that this is what's the case. Then Allah gave the husband an avenue to accuse his wife. And that's called li'an. And that was given in Surah An-Nur. And li'an is, he swears four times by Allah that she has done this act. And the fifth time he swears that if she has not done this act and I'm accusing her falsely, then I pray Allah's rage and curse comes on me. And she has to respond to that li'an and say, four times swearing by Allah, he's wrong, I haven't done anything wrong. And the fifth time, she's calling on the rage and curse of Allah on herself if she's in fact a liar. If she doesn't testify to that, because by the way, what's the purpose of doing that? Now you're putting your akhirah at stake. This is a criminal case in dunya. And if it's proven, then the punishment will be the same. Al-Azab. Al-Azab, which is the lashing that's been described in Surah An-Nur. But if it's not proven, and one of them is a liar, they didn't just lose a case or win a case in dunya, they have now compromised their akhirah because they have invited Allah's curse on them just to win a false case, to save themselves in this life. Then they've compromised their akhirah. Why is this so important? Because Allah considers this relationship so sacred that if you're going to accuse someone falsely, then you better be willing to give up your entire akhirah for it. It's that expensive. And if you want to save yourself the shame from this life and do the deed, do the zina, and then swear by Allah, if I've done it, may Allah's curse be on me, then Allah's curse will be on you. You just gave up your akhirah to save yourself some face in this dunya. That's the notion. Now the Quran, يُفَسِّرُ بَعْضُهُ بَعْضًا. I told you in this ayah in the beginning, when it came to counsel, it's not just the husband necessarily. It's the family, others can get involved. Then the second step. What's the second step? Separating the beds. Now the husband is involved. But when it came to hitting, the surah already described, the only time you can physically strike someone for this act is if you have either four witnesses or you have li'an. In other words, the authorities have to step in. The authorities, if you're going to strike them, it's not I get to hit them. The point here is all of these ayat together are making a conclusion that the family institution has to be saved by the extended family, by the efforts of the husband and the wife together. And if the worst case happens, then the state has to get involved. And when the state gets involved, like happened in the time of Umar ibn Khattab radiallahu ta'ala anhu, a man accused his wife of nushuz, and he gave her counsel. It's interesting. Why is Umar giving somebody else's wife counsel? Why isn't the husband himself giving counsel? Because he understood the ayah is not limited to the husband. And then he noticed that the nushuz hasn't stopped, so he actually had her quarantined for a few days, which implements the second part of the ayah, which is what? You know, وَهَجُرُهُنَّ فِي الْمَضَاجِعِ. And then when that didn't work, and he asked her, are you going to go back and be normal now? Are you going to go back to not violating your husband's rights? She said, wallahi, I'm not going to stop. And that was it. There was no third step. You know why? Because the husband didn't say that I saw her do zina. And there were no four witnesses. So the darb could never happen. Umar ibn Khattab radiallahu anhu is actually implementing the ayah as it's understood. And so he doesn't even take the third step because that the room for that wasn't there. So what is this teaching us? If you study the ayat of zina and the ayat of saving marriage in the Quran, you'll notice a trend. You know what that trend is? That Allah wants the husband and wife to do their best to save the marriage. Then Allah wants people that know them to try to intervene to save the marriage. And then finally, if the worst of it happens, that has a threat of disrupting society itself, then the government, community, authorities, then the Islamic authorities get involved. And such a case is brought. وَضْرِبُوهُنَّ. فَإِنْ أَطَعْنَكُمْ And if they obey you, what does obedience now mean? Well, if disobedience in this ayah or rebellion was infidelity, but if they come back to not violating those rights, فَلَا تَبْغُوا عَلَيْهِنَّ سَبِيلًا Then don't make a case against them. You know, ابْتِغَاءُ السَّبِيلَ is a figure of speech in Arabic, actually means to make a case against someone. And literally, the implication here is the same. And the implication is that this is not an open license. And this is why we understand the words of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. He says, La tadribu ima Allah. Don't hit the female slaves of Allah. Don't hit the female slaves of Allah. What is he? And he says this in the plural form. You know what that means? This is a general condition for the Muslims. We don't hit women. We don't hit women. And then in the most extreme, rare circumstances, the hudud are implemented. And what is that hitting? That hitting is actually the same as the jald that's mentioned in Surah An-Nur and other places. And now this is a rich conversation. There's lots of evidences. There's a lots of correlation between different texts. There's lots of linguistic evidence, which is not the space for a khutbah. Which is why what I want to do, and ayat like these, I do believe we should take our time to discuss. I do believe we should examine all the evidences. I do believe we should have all the back and forth that there should be had on places like this in the Quran, so the Ummah has a well-informed opinion about what this stuff means. And it's not just so we can answer some non-Muslim criticism of the Quran or some non-Muslim criticism of Islam. This is for ourselves. We've got to teach this religion to the coming generations. We've got to live by this thing, this timeless teaching that Allah has given us. And we cannot do that if we don't raise the bar, if we don't inform ourselves. So as this is my last khutbah on this subject in the form of khutbah, what I'd like to tell you is, inshallah, over the coming weeks, I'll be broadcasting conversations with the author of the paper, section by section. What did he conclude in the first section? Why? What are the counter arguments? What are the claims against this conclusion? Next section, same thing. Next section, same thing. Next section, same thing. So that everybody can see the process behind reaching such a conclusion. It's easy to just, I could just say the same thing. Don't hit them and just say it and then move on, right? But I don't want to speak about the Quran in a way that isn't thorough, especially on something that you can say there's a difference about it. There's contentious views and there's different kinds of views about it. So looking at all of the ahadith, looking at all of the linguistic evidence, looking at all of the ayat of the Quran, and reconciling all of that and constructing a narrative that is true to the word of Allah. As true as we can be. And at the end of that, what we can say in the end is Allahu Ta'ala A'lam, that Allah Azza wa Jal knows better. But in this, the last thing I'll share with you is in the next khutbah maybe, or even before the khutbah, I will be talking about the flip side of this equation. Meaning, nushuz is for women, and that's what this ayah talked about, but there's also nushuz for men. And why is there a difference? Because if you study that ayah number 128, it's a very different conclusion, very different set of advice that Allah gives about men having nushuz as opposed to women having nushuz. And women can read that, or anybody can read that and say, there looks like there's a double standard here. They're not getting hit. Because he said, وَضْرِبُهُنَّ But he didn't say, وَضْرِبُهُمْ He didn't say any such thing. So how come he didn't say that? What's going on here? How do we understand it? So that conversation also needs to be had. Because we have to have tama'ninatul qalb when we study the book of Allah. If something's not making sense to you, if something's not sitting well, Ya Allah, I don't understand it. How is this fair? Ya Allah, I don't understand it. How does this meet with the fitrah? Then we have to sit and talk it out. We can't just swallow it and say, no, I don't have to question anything, because shaitan will use that unanswered question in your heart. He will use that against you and brew doubts about your deen inside your heart. And that's more dangerous than anything else. That's the worst thing that can happen to your iman and mine. May Allah Azza wa Jal give us ultimate loyalty to His word and a commitment to not be afraid of saying what should be said in our loyalty to Allah and His Messenger sallallahu alayhi wasallam. And may Allah continue to grow our understanding, our love, and our appreciation of His book and His Messenger sallallahu alayhi wasallam. Barakallahu li wa lakum fil Qur'an al-Hakim wa nafa'ani wa iyyakum bil ayati wa dhikri al-Hakim. الحمد لله وكفى والصلاة والسلام على عباده الذين اصطفى خصوصا على أفضلهم وخاتم النبيين محمد الأمين وعلى آله وصحبه أجمعين قال الله عز وجل في كتابه الكريم بعد أن أقول أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم إن الله وملائكته يصلون على النبي يا أيها الذين آمنوا صلوا عليه وسلموا تسليما اللهم صل على محمد وعلى آل محمد كما صليت على إبراهيم وعلى آل إبراهيم في العالمين إنك حميد مجيد اللهم بارك على محمد وعلى آل محمد كما باركت على إبراهيم وعلى آل إبراهيم في العالمين إنك حميد مجيد. عباد الله رحمكم الله، اتقوا الله. إن الله يأمر بالعدل والإحسان وإيتاء ذي القربى وينهى عن الفحشاء والمنكر ولذكر الله أكبر والله يعلم ما تصنعون. أقم الصلاة إن الصلاة كانت على المؤمنين كتابا موقوتا.